with no usable customer reference gained. Caught in this situation, the entrepreneurial company has only one adequate response, a truly unhappy one. Shut down its marketing efforts, admit its mistakes to its investors, and focus all its energies into turning its pilot projects into something useful. First, in terms of a deliverable to the customer, and ultimately in terms of a marketable product. Since most entrepreneurial companies are fueled, as much as anything, on the ego of their founders, this is too often the road not taken, thereby keeping bankruptcy lawyers, and, sadder still, frequently divorce lawyers, in full employment. Problem number 3. Marketing falls prey to the crack between a technology enthusiast and the visionary by failing to discover, or at least failing to articulate, the compelling application that provides the order of magnitude leap in benefits. A number of companies buy the product to test it out, but it never gets incorporated into a major system rollout, because the rewards never quite measure up to the risks. The resulting lack of revenue leads to folding the effort, either by shutting it down entirely or selling it off for scrap to another enterprise. The corrective response here begins with reevaluating what we have. If it is not, in fact, a breakthrough product, then it is not ever going to create an early market. But perhaps it could serve as a supplementary product in an existing mainstream market. If that is indeed the case, then the right response is to swallow our pride, reduce our financial expectations, and subordinate ourselves to an existing mainstream market company who can put our product in play through its existing channels. Computer Associates, one of the largest software companies in the world, was built up almost entirely on this principle of remarketing other companies' often cast-off products. Alternatively, if we truly have a breakthrough product, but we are stalled in getting the early market moving, then we have to step down from the lofty theoretical plateau on which we have established that this product can be part of any number of exciting applications. Then we must get very practical about focusing on one application, making sure that it is indeed a compelling one for at least one visionary who is already familiar with us, and then committing to that visionary in return for his or her support to removing every obstacle to getting that application adopted. These are some of the most common ways in which an early market development effort can go off and be put back on track. For the most part, the problems are solvable because there are always multiple options at the outset of anything. The biggest problem is typically overly ambitious expectations combined with undercapitalization. Or, as my grandmother used to put it, when your eyes are bigger than your stomach. Things get a lot more complex when we are dealing with the dynamics of mainstream markets, to which we shall now turn. Mainstream markets. Mainstream markets in high tech look a lot like mainstream markets in any other industry, particularly those that sell business to business. They are dominated by the early majority, who in high tech are best understood as pragmatists, who in turn tend to be accepted as leaders by the late majority, best thought of as conservatives, and rejected as leaders by the laggards, or skeptics. As in the previous chapter, we are going to look closely at how the psychographics of each of these groups influences the development and dynamics of a high-tech market. Early majority, the pragmatists. Throughout the 1980s, the early majority, or pragmatists, have represented the bulk of the market volume for any technology product. You can succeed with the visionaries, and you can thereby get a reputation for being a high flyer with a hot product. But that is not ultimately where the dollars are. Instead, those funds are in the hands of more prudent souls, who do not want to be pioneers. Pioneers are people with arrows in their backs, who never volunteer to be an early test site, let somebody else debug your product, and who have learned the hard way that the leading edge of technology is all too often the bleeding edge. Who are the pragmatists? Actually, important as they are hard to characterize because they do not have the visionary's penchant for drawing attention to themselves. They are not the Hamlets, but the Horatios. Not the Don Quixotes, but the Sancho Panzas. A character more like the X-Files' Dana Scully than Fox Mulder. More like Lethal Weapon's Sergeant Murtaugh than Martin Riggs. People who do not assert a position in life so much as derive one from what life provides. Never the standout. They are what makes for the continuity. So that after the star either dies, tragedy, or rides off into the sunset, heroic romance, comedy, they are left to clean up and to answer the inevitable final question, who was that masked man? In the realm of high tech, pragmatist CEOs are not common, and those there are, true to their type, tend to keep a relatively low profile. Ray Lane of Oracle, as opposed to Larry Ellison. Craig Barrett of Intel, as opposed to Andy Grove. Lou Platt of Hewlett-Packard, as opposed to Scott McNeely at Sun. And Carol Bartz at Autodesk, all come to mind. They tend to be best known by their closest colleagues, from whom they typically have earned the highest respect, and by their peers within their industry, where they show up near the top of the leaderboard year after year. Of course, to market successfully to pragmatists, one does not have to be one. Just understand their values and work to serve them. To look more closely into these values, if the goal of visionaries is to take a quantum leap forward, the goal of pragmatists is to make a percentage improvement, incremental, measurable, predictable progress. If they are installing a new product, they want to know how other people have fared with it. The word risk is a negative word in their vocabulary. It does not connote opportunity or excitement, but rather the chance to waste money and time. They will undertake risks when required, but they first will put in place safety nets and manage the risks very closely. The Fortune 2000 MIS community, as a group, is led by people who are largely pragmatist in orientation. Business demands for increased productivity push them toward the front of the adoption life cycle. But natural prudence and budget restrictions keep them cautious. As individuals, pragmatists held back from buying Windows until release 3.0, held back from client-server applications until PeopleSoft, Oracle, and SAP gave three safe choices, and are still trying to figure out today how far to let the internet into their corporate environments. If pragmatists are hard to win over, they are loyal once won, often enforcing a company standard that requires the purchase of your product and only your product for a given requirement. This focus on standardization is, well, pragmatic, in that it simplifies internal service demands. But the secondary effects of this standardization, increasing sales volumes and lowering the cost of sales, is dramatic. Hence, the importance of pragmatists as a market segment. The most celebrated example and beneficiary of this effect in the last decade has been Microsoft. We tend to think of Microsoft's dominance in operating systems as exclusive today. But actually, as the desktop and workgroup server markets were developing, they supported a variety of vendors, each with its own pragmatist enclave. In the engineering community, they gravitated to Sun Solaris. In the graphics community, to Apple's Macintosh OS. In the workgroup, to Novell NetWare. In the Fortune 500 replicated site environments of branch banking and retail, to OS2. In the VAR-dominated professional services systems for doctors and dentists, to SCO Unix. Each one of these companies rode a pragmatist wave within a specific market to boost its sales a quantum leap upward. It is crucial, therefore, for any long-term strategic marketing plan to understand the pragmatist buyers and to focus on winning their trust. When pragmatists buy, they care about the company they are buying from, the quality of the product they are buying, the infrastructure of supporting products and system interfaces, and the reliability of the service they are going to get. In other words, they are planning on living with this decision personally for a long time to come. By contrast, the visionaries are more likely to be planning on implementing the Great New Order and then using that as a springboard to their next great career step upward. Because pragmatists are in it for the long haul, and because they control the bulk of the dollars in the marketplace, the rewards for building relationships of trust with them are very much worth the effort. Pragmatists tend to be vertically oriented, meaning that they communicate more with others like themselves within their own industry than do technology enthusiasts and early adopters, who are more likely to communicate horizontally across industry boundaries in search of kindred spirits. This means it is very tough to break into a new industry selling to pragmatists. References and relationships are very important to these people, and there is a kind of catch-22 operating. Pragmatists won't buy from you until you are established, yet you can't get established until they buy from you. Obviously, this works to the disadvantage of startups, and conversely, to the great advantage of companies with well-established track records. On the other hand, once a startup has earned its spurs with the pragmatist buyers within a given vertical market, they tend to be very loyal to it and even go out of their way to help it succeed. When this happens, the cost of sales goes way down, and the leverage on incremental R&D to support any given customer goes way up. That's one of the reasons pragmatists make such a great market. There is no one distribution channel preferred by pragmatists, but they do want to keep the sum total of their distribution relationships to a minimum. This allows them to maximize their buying leverage and maintain a few clear points of control, should anything go wrong. In some cases, this prejudice can be overcome if the pragmatist buyer knows a particular salesperson from a previous relationship. As a rule, however, the path into the pragmatist community is smoother if a smaller entrepreneurial vendor can develop an alliance with one of the already accepted vendors, or if it can establish a value-added reseller, VAR, sales base. VARs, if they truly specialize in the pragmatist's particular industry, and if they have a reputation for delivering quality work on time and within budget, represent an extremely attractive type of solution to a pragmatist. They can provide a turnkey answer to a problem without impacting internal resources already overloaded with the burdens of ongoing system maintenance. What the pragmatist likes best about VARs is that they represent a single point of control, a single company to call if anything goes wrong. One final characteristic of pragmatist buyers is that they like to see competition, in part to get costs down, in part to have the security of more than one alternative to fall back on, should anything go wrong, and in part to assure themselves they are buying from a proven market leader. This last point is crucial. Pragmatists want to buy from proven market leaders because they know that third parties will design supporting products around a market-leading product. That is, market-leading products create an aftermarket that other vendors service. This radically reduces pragmatist customers' burden of support. By contrast, if they mistakenly choose a product that does not become the market leader, but rather one of the also-rans, then this highly valued aftermarket support does not develop, and they will be stuck making all the enhancements by themselves. Market leadership is crucial, therefore, to winning pragmatist customers. Pragmatists are reasonably price-sensitive. They are willing to pay a modest premium for top quality or special services, but in the absence of any special differentiation, they want the best deal. That's because, having typically made a career commitment to their job and/or their company, they get measured year in and year out on what their operation has spent versus what it has returned to the corporation. Overall, to market to pragmatists, you must be patient. You need to be conversant with the issues that dominate their particular business. You need to show up at the industry-specific conferences and trade shows they attend. You need to be mentioned in articles that run in the magazines they read. You need to be installed in other companies in their industry. You need to have developed applications for your product that are specific to the industry. You need to have partnerships and alliances with the other vendors who serve their industry. You need to have earned a reputation for quality and service. In short, you need to make yourself over into the obvious supplier of choice. This is a long-term agenda, requiring careful pacing, recurrent investment, and a mature management team. One of its biggest payoffs, on the other hand, is that it not only delivers the pragmatist element of the technology adoption lifecycle, but tees up the conservative element as well. Sadly, however, high-tech industry has, for the most part, not seen fit to reap the rewards it has so carefully sown. To see how this has come about, let us now take a closer look at the conservatives. Late majority. The conservatives. The mathematics of the technology adoption lifecycle model says that for every pragmatist, there is a conservative. Put another way, conservatives represent approximately one-third of the total available customers within any given technology adoption lifecycle. As a marketable segment, however, they are rarely developed as profitably as they could be, largely because high-tech companies are not, as a rule, in sympathy with them. Conservatives, in essence, are against discontinuous innovations. They believe far more in tradition than in progress. And when they find something that works for them, they like to stick with it. Most people in high-tech think of Esther Dyson, for example, as a visionary. But when it comes to word processing, she is a conservative, clinging to using ZYWrite, her original word processor from the early 1980s, long after the rest of us were on Microsoft Word. It works for her, and that is the key criterion. I personally feel the same way about America Online. Among the techno-chic, AOL is very unchic, but it works for me. In this sense, conservatives have more in common with early adopters than one might think. Both can be stubborn in their resistance to the call to conform that unites the pragmatist herd. To be sure, in many cases, both do succumb to the new paradigm, long after it was really new, just to stay on par with the rest of the world. But just because conservatives use such products, they don't necessarily have to like them. The truth is, conservatives often fear high-tech a little bit. Therefore, they tend to invest only at the end of a technology lifecycle, when products are extremely mature, market share competition is driving low prices, and the products themselves can be treated as commodities. Often their real goal in buying high-tech products is simply not to get stung. Unfortunately, because they are working the low-margin end of the market, where there is little motive for the seller to build a high-integrity relationship with the buyer, they often do get stung. This only reinforces their disillusion with high-tech and resets the buying cycle at an even more cynical level. If high-tech businesses are going to be successful over the long term, they must learn to break this vicious circle and establish a reasonable basis for conservatives to want to do business with them. They must understand that conservatives do not have high aspirations about their high-tech investments, and hence will not support high price margins. Nonetheless, through sheer volume, they can offer great rewards to the companies that serve them appropriately. It is easy to understand conservatives if you can observe some aspect of their buying behavior within yourself. In my case, I am a late adopter of many kinds of consumer products. I did not buy my first CD until 1998. I carry a pager, but do not give out the number. I carry a cell phone, but never turn it on. When offered a GPS navigational option on my car, I declined. In general, I hate being connected, which I associate with being either interrupted or confused, not being in touch. And thus, there are whole chunks of consumer technology that I want no part of. I'm uncomfortable with most types of personal finance transactions, and I'm a very late adopter of any new kind of investment opportunity. Getting in touch with feelings like these helps one market to conservatives. Conservatives like to buy pre-assembled packages with everything bundled at a heavily discounted price. The last thing they want to hear is that the software they just bought doesn't support the printer they have installed. They want high-tech products to be like refrigerators. You open the door, the light comes on automatically, your food stays cold, and you don't have to think about it. The products they understand best are those dedicated to a single function: word processors, calculators, copiers, and fax machines. The notion that a single computer could do all four of these functions does not excite them. Instead, it is something they find vaguely nauseating. The conservative marketplace provides a great opportunity in this regard to take low-cost, trailing-edge technology components and repackage them into single-function systems for specific business needs. The quality of the package should be quite high, because there is nothing in it that has not already been thoroughly debugged. The price should be quite low, because all the R&D has long since been amortized, and every bit of the manufacturing learning curve has been taken advantage of. It is, in short, not just a pure marketing ploy, but a true solution for a new class of customer. There are two keys to success here. The first is to have thoroughly thought through the whole solution to a particular target end user market's needs, and to have provided for every element of that solution within the package. This is critical because there is no profit margin to support an after-purchase support system. The other key is to have lined up a low overhead distribution channel that can get this package to the target market effectively. Conservatives have enormous value to high-tech industry and that they greatly extend the market for high-tech components that are no longer state-of-the-art. The fact that the United States has all but conceded great hunks of this market to the Far East is testimony not so much to the cost advantages of offshore manufacturing as to the failure of onshore product planning and marketing imagination. Many Far East solutions today still bring only one value to the table: low cost. That is, they are nowhere near the goal of being a whole product solution. Thus, they typically have to go through a VAR channel in order to be upgraded to the kind of complete system that a conservative can purchase. The difficulty in this distribution strategy is that few VARs are large enough to achieve the volume needed to leverage a conservative market. Far more dollars could be mined from this segment of the high-tech marketplace if American leading-edge manufacturers and marketers, with their high-volume channels and vast purchasing resources, simply paid more attention to it. So, the conservative market is still something that high tech has in its future more than in its past. To be sure, a few companies have staked out their claims. Xerox and the rest of the copier industry, despite their outward emphasis on going digital, still use strong distribution channel services to stay close to conservative customers, offering to outsource the operations of anything that seems too daunting to handle in-house. Cell phones have now reached sufficient saturation of the pragmatist market to reach out to conservatives with popular offers such as a AAA phone, which has a dedicated button for calling for roadside service, an offer that cuts through the conservatives' techno-anxiety to allay another set of fears. And purveyors to the home PC market have come a long way in orchestrating the out-of-box experience, such that a non-technical person can get up and running and have a successful first experience within 20 minutes. Witness our recent purchase of an iMac, where the toughest decision was choosing the color, grape. Despite such successes, however, one has the feeling that the conservative market is perceived more as a burden than an opportunity. High-tech business success within it will require a new kind of marketing imagination linked to a less venturesome financial model. The dollars are there for the making if we can meet new challenges that are as yet only partially familiar. However, as the cost of R&D radically escalates, companies are going to have to amortize that cost across bigger and bigger markets, and this must inevitably lead to the long-ignored back half of the technology adoption curve. The dynamics of mainstream markets. Just as visionaries drive the development of the early market, so do the pragmatists drive the development of the mainstream market. Winning their support is not only the point of entry, but the key to long-term dominance. But having done so, you cannot take the market for granted. To maintain leadership in a mainstream market, you must at least keep pace with the competition. It is no longer necessary to be the technology leader, nor is it necessary to have the very best product. But the product must be good enough, and should a competitor make a major breakthrough, you have to make at least a catch-up response. No one is better at playing this game than Oracle Corporation and its president, Larry Ellison. Oracle won the pragmatist market away from Relational Technology Inc., now called Ask Ingress, by virtue of a single brilliant move, standardizing on SQL as its interface language. Because IBM was driving SQL to become a standard, Oracle could ride their coattails. But then it went one step further. It ported Oracle and the SQL interface to every piece of hardware it could find, something IBM could not, or at least certainly would not, consider doing. This appeared to solve what was rapidly becoming the single biggest headache for pragmatists, the proliferation of incompatible systems that sooner or later would have to be made to communicate with each other. Everyone and his mother wanted to be the glue to hold these systems together. Oracle won the job. Having done so, however, Oracle did not sit back and take the market for granted. The independent software vendors at Ingress, Informix, and Sybase, not to mention the in-house database groups at IBM, DEC, Tandem, and Hewlett-Packard, were coming after them. Ingress came out with IngressNet and IngressStar to provide the data communications gateways to link the incompatible systems. Oracle responded with SQLStar and SQLNet. Did they actually have comparable products? No, but neither really did Ingress. They had pre-announced. By the time real products started getting to real customers, Oracle was already on the way to closing the technology gap. Besides, most pragmatists did not want to undertake all this linking right away. They just wanted to know there was a growth path in the works. As long as Oracle could demonstrate that, they could keep the leadership position. Along came Sybase and took a technology leadership position in something called Distributed Online Transaction Processing based on client-server architecture. Never mind that at present, this is a relatively small niche market. It is technologically where the future of database systems is headed. Once again, Oracle did not ignore this potential threat. It announced its own client-server architecture. Indeed, claimed it had had it all along. And again, just the plan for such a topology has been enough to keep the mainstream market reasonably well under control. Of course, Oracle did not invent this sort of strategy. The credit there, at least for high tech, has to go to its greatest practitioner, IBM. Nevertheless, few companies have been as competitive as Oracle. Indeed, several have shown how you can lose a mainstream market, despite everyone's efforts, including your own customers, to prevent that. Here are some of the more common ways. Stop investing in the market. Cease funding R&D to match the competition, and milk it for money to invest elsewhere. This is what Novell did with its core netware business in the local area network market. Once it had established market leadership there, it shifted its focus to porting to mainframe and mini computers, to buying up other applications, notably WordPerfect, and other operating systems, Unix, and to futuristic dreams like Nest for home appliance networking. All the while, Microsoft NT was looming as a workgroup alternative. The key to defending this market was for Novell to improve NetWare's support for database applications, a technology called NetWare Loadable Modules, that for years had limped along and really needed refurbishing. But Novell never found time for that, whereas Microsoft, by linking its SQL server to its NT offer, did. When NT finally began to displace the NetWare server, Novell woke up. But by then, it was too late. As the century comes to a close, the company is trying to rebuild a franchise around some superb offerings in directory services. But it is working from a position of weakness, for which it has only itself to blame. Shoot yourself in the flagship product. This is what Autodesk did with Release 13 of AutoCAD, the industry standard for PC-based mechanical and industrial design. The company had lagged technology development in prior releases and targeted this one to make up for lost ground by introducing 3D CAD along with a host of other changes and additions. The product was confusing. Its performance was embarrassingly slow. The customers stayed away in droves, and Autodesk's distribution partners hit the roof. But here is where a commitment to market leadership pays off. Despite all the criticism Autodesk got, nobody defected from their camp. They just beat them up and withheld their dollars. And so the company hunkered down, got an interim performance release out, and then launched Release 14, which got gold stars. Since that release, it has been enjoying a surge in sales, essentially recouping much of what it had previously left on the table, and is back on track. The key point here is that mainstream customers truly abhor discontinuous innovations. Switching to another PC CAD system will be incredibly disruptive to their operations, whether they are an in-house operation or a VAP of systems that incorporate AutoCAD. By righting its ship and staying its course, Autodesk was able to leverage these switching costs to its advantage and reassert its market position. Novell and Autodesk both made serious marketing errors that jeopardized their mainstream market leadership positions. Why? Part of the answer has to be that they were thinking with the wrong marketing model. Their decision showed them to be overly focused on what was going on in early markets and too inattentive to the underdeveloped elements in the mainstream, In particular, they were not paying any attention at all to extending their market share to incorporate more conservatives. There's been some improvement in mainstream marketing to conservatives during this last decade, but it is still more the exception than the rule. To be fair, in many parts of high tech, technology adoption life cycles come rolling in one after another so fast that it seems there is no time for Main Street. But that is more perception than reality. Take the case of the proprietary mini computer. Surely, with the advent of Unix and NT, these products should be dead as doornails. And indeed, some very fine ones are. Wang, Prime, Apollo, Convex, Data General, and even Digital are all basically on the shelf. But in the midst of this, as the century comes to a close, two franchises, the AS400 and the HP 3000, are resurging. Both have made concerted efforts to market directly to conservatives. They have both taken technology developed by other divisions, thereby keeping their incremental costs low, to keep their platforms up to current performance standards. At the same time, they have leveraged their installed base of applications to nurture loyal customers and even get some new ones. Customer service is key to their business, as is the ability to make add-on offers that incrementally upgrade capabilities without technological risk. More disk space, more memory, links to client-server systems, links to the internet. All outboard of the core system, which lies relatively untouched, chugging along, reliable as all get out, and fully paid for. The key to making a smooth transition from the pragmatist to the conservative market segments is to maintain a strong relationship with the former, always giving them an open door to go to the new paradigm, while still keeping the latter happy by adding value to the old infrastructure. It is a balancing act, to say the least. But properly managed, the earnings potential in loyal, mature market segments is very high indeed. In this regard, if we now look back over the first four profiles in the technology adoption lifecycle, we see an interesting trend. The importance of the product itself, its unique functionality, when compared to the importance of the ancillary services to the customer, is at its highest with the technology enthusiast, and at its lowest with the conservative. This is no surprise, since one's level of involvement and competence with a high-tech product are a prime indicator of when one will enter the technology adoption lifecycle. The key lesson is that the longer your product is in the market, the more mature it becomes, and the more important the service element is to the customer. Conservatives, in particular, are extremely service-oriented. Now, it would be a much simpler world if conservatives were willing to pay for all this service they require. But they are not. So the corollary lesson is, we must use our experience with the pragmatist customer segment to identify all the issues that require service, and then design solutions to these problems directly into the product. This must be the focus of mature market R&D. Not the extension of functionality, not the massive rewrite from the ground up, but the gradual incorporation into the product of all the little aids that people develop, often on their own, to help them cope with its limitations. This is service indeed, for the best service, both from the point of view of convenience to the customer and low cost to the vendor, is no service at all. Not following this path makes us vulnerable to the crack in the bell curve that separates pragmatists from conservatives. The latter are not anxious to admit to their pragmatist friends that they are unwilling or unable to step up to the same level of technological self-support. But that is, in fact, one of the key differentiating factors between the two groups. To date, high tech has not widely acknowledged this gap, with the result that the industry has experienced product life cycles that are far shorter than need be and revenue streams that are far more dependent on the success of new products, and hence far more volatile, than in other industries. All that being said, it is not high-tech's inability to transition its marketing efforts effectively between the pragmatists and the conservatives that poses the greatest threat to its well-being. That honor, as we shall see in the next chapter, goes to another transition in the technology adoption lifecycle, the place where high-tech fortunes truly are made or lost, crossing the chasm between the early market with its visionaries and the mainstream market with its pragmatists. Before passing on, however, to our main theme, there is one last element in the technology adoption lifecycle that deserves at least a passing comment. Laggards, the skeptics. Skeptics, the group that makes up the last one-sixth of the technology adoption lifecycle, do not participate in the high-tech marketplace except to block purchases. Thus, the primary function of high-tech marketing in relation to skeptics is to neutralize their influence. In a sense, this is a pity, because skeptics can teach us a lot about what we are doing wrong. Hence this postscript. One of the favorite arguments of skeptics is that the billions of dollars invested in office automation have not improved the productivity of the office place one iota. Actually, some fairly good data exist to support this notion. Nonetheless, as you might expect, this argument outrages high-tech supporters, who can point to any number of obvious ways in which the industry eliminates or facilitates routine, or even non-routine, office chores. But what if, instead of rushing to rebuttal, marketing were to explore the merits of the skeptic's argument? What we might find, for example, is that while high-tech products do give time back to the individual does not necessarily give that time back to the corporation. Or we might find that the capabilities designed and manufactured into the system at great expense remain buried in the system, because the user never learns about them. Or we might find that for every individual who can transform the hours invested in training into competence in a high-tech product, there might be another who cannot. The loss associated with these people is high, considering not just their time spent in training, along with any trainer time, but also the cost of the system bought to support them, the system they cannot effectively use. The point is, as any experienced seller of high-tech products can tell you, cost justification of high-tech purchases is a shaky venture at best. There is always the potential to return significant dollars, but it always depends on factors beyond the system itself. Put another way, this simply means that the claims that salespeople made for high-tech products are really claims made for whole product solutions that incorporate elements well beyond whatever high-tech manufacturers ship inside their boxes. If high-tech marketers do not take responsibility for seeing that the whole product solution is being delivered, then they are giving the skeptic an opening to block the sale. For all the reasons just cited, the significance of whole product solutions is discussed at length later, as the key component of successfully crossing the chasm and entering into the mainstream. What skeptics are struggling to point out is that new systems, for the most part, don't deliver on the promises that were made at the time of their purchase. This is not to say they do not end up delivering value, but rather that the value they actually deliver is not often anticipated at the time of purchase. If this is true, and to some degree, I believe it is, it means that committing to a new system is a much greater act of faith than normally imagined. It means that the primary value in the act derives more from such notions as supporting a bias toward action than from any quantifiable packet of cost-justified benefits. The idea that the value of the system will be discovered rather than known at the time of installation, implies, in turn, that product flexibility and adaptability, as well as ongoing account service, should be critical components of any buyer's evaluation checklist. Ultimately, the service that skeptics provide to high-tech marketers is to point continually to the discrepancies between the sales claims and the delivered product. These discrepancies, in turn, create opportunities for the customer to fail. And such failures, through word of mouth, will ultimately come back to haunt us as lost market share. Steamrolling over the skeptics, in other words, may be a great sales tactic, but it is a poor marketing one. From a marketing point of view, we are all subject to the Emperor's New Clothes syndrome, but particularly so in high tech, where every player in the market has a vested interest in boosting the overall perception of the industry. Skeptics don't buy our act. We ought to take advantage of that fact. Back to the chasm. As the preceding pages indicate, there is clearly a lot of value in the technology adoption lifecycle as a marketing model. By isolating the psychographics of customers based on when they tend to enter the market, it gives clear guidance on how to develop a marketing program for an innovative product. The basic flaw in the model, as we have said, is that it implies a smooth and continuous progression across segments over the life of a product, whereas experience teaches just the opposite. Indeed, making the marketing and communications transition between any two adoption segments is normally excruciatingly awkward because you must adopt new strategies just at the time you have become most comfortable with the old ones. The biggest problem during this transition period is the lack of a customer base that can be referenced at the time of making the transition into a new segment. As we saw when we redrew the technology adoption lifecycle, the spaces between segments indicate the credibility gap that arises from seeking to use the group on the left as a reference base to penetrate the segment on the right. In some cases, the basic affinities of the market keep groups relatively close together. Early adopting visionaries, for example, tend to keep in touch with and respect the views of technology enthusiasts. This is because they need the latter to serve as a reality check on the technical feasibility of their vision and to help evaluate specific products. As a result, enthusiasts can speak to at least some of the visionaries' concerns. In a comparable way, conservatives look to pragmatists to help lead them in their technology purchases. Both groups like to see themselves as members of a particular industry first, business people second, and purchasers of technology third. Pragmatists, however, have more confidence in technology as a potential benefit and in their ability to make sound technology purchases. Conservatives are considerably more nervous about both. They are willing to go along, up to a point, with pragmatists they respect, but they are still slightly unnerved by pragmatists' overall self-confidence. So once again, the reference base has partial value in transitioning between adoption segments. The significance of this weakening in the reference base traces back to the fundamental point made about markets in the introduction. Namely, that markets, particularly high-tech markets, are made up of people who reference each other during the buying decision. As we move from segment to segment in the technology adoption lifecycle, we may have any number of references built up, but they may not be of the right sort. Nowhere is this better seen than in the transition between visionaries and pragmatists. If there are, to some extent, minor gaps between the other adoption groups, between visionaries and pragmatists, there is a great, and to a large extent, greatly ignored, chasm. If we look deep into that chasm, we see four fundamental characteristics of visionaries that alienate pragmatists. 1. Lack of respect for the value of colleagues' experiences. Visionaries are the first people in their industry segment to see the potential of the new technology. Fundamentally, they see themselves as smarter than their opposite numbers in competitive companies. And quite often, they are. Indeed, it is their ability to see things first that they want to leverage into a competitive advantage. That advantage can only come about if no one else has discovered it. They do not expect, therefore, to be buying a well-tested product with an extensive list of industry references. Indeed, if such a reference base exists, it may actually turn them off, indicating that for this technology, at any rate, they are already too late. Pragmatists, on the other hand, deeply value the experience of their colleagues in other companies. When they buy, they expect extensive references, and they want a good number to come from companies in their own industry segment. This, as we have already noted, creates a catch-22 situation. Since there are usually only one or two visionaries per industry segment, how can you accumulate the number of references a pragmatist requires, when virtually everyone left to call on is also a pragmatist? 2. Taking a greater interest in technology than in their industry. Visionaries are defining the future. You meet them at technology conferences and other futurist forums where people gather to forecast trends and seek out new market opportunities. They are easy to strike up a conversation with, and they understand and appreciate what high-tech companies and high-tech products are trying to do. They want to talk ideas with bright people. They are bored with the mundane details of their own industries. They like to talk and think high-tech. Pragmatists, on the other hand, don't put a lot of stake in futuristic things. They see themselves more in present-day terms, as the people devoted to making the wheels of their industry turn. Therefore, they tend to invest their convention time in industry-specific forums discussing industry-specific issues. Where pragmatists are concerned, sweeping changes and global advantages may make for fine speeches, but not much else. 3. Failing to recognize the importance of existing product infrastructure. Visionaries are building systems from the ground up. They are incarnating their vision. They do not expect to find components for these systems lying around. They do not expect standards to have been established. Indeed, they are planning to set new standards. They do not expect support groups to be in place, procedures to have been established, or third parties to be available to share in the workload and the responsibility. Pragmatists expect all these things. When they see visionaries going their own route with little or no thought of connecting with the mainstream practices in their industry, they shudder. Pragmatists have based their careers on such connections. Once again, it is painfully obvious that visionaries, as a group, make a very poor reference base for pragmatists. 4. Overall disruptiveness. From a pragmatist's point of view, visionaries are the people who come in and soak up all the budget for their pet projects. If the project is a success, they take all the credit, while the pragmatists get stuck trying to maintain a system that is so state-of-the-art, no one is quite sure how to keep it working. If the project fails, visionaries always seem to be a step ahead of the disaster, getting out of town while they can, and leaving the pragmatists to clean up the mess. Visionaries, successful or not, don't plan to stick around long. They see themselves on a fast track that has them leapfrogging up the corporate ladder and across corporations. Pragmatists, on the other hand, tend to be committed long-term to their profession and the company at which they work. They are very cautious about grandiose schemes, because they know they will have to live with the results. All in all, it is easy to see why pragmatists are not anxious to reference visionaries in their buying decisions. Hence, the chasm. This situation can be further complicated if the high-tech company, fresh from its marketing successes with visionaries, neglects to change its sales pitch. Thus, the company may be trumpeting its recent success at early test sites when what the pragmatist really wants to hear about are up-and-running production installations. Or the company may be saying state-of-the-art when the pragmatist wants to hear industry standard. The problem goes beyond pitches and positioning, though. It is fundamentally a problem of time. The high-tech vendor wants, indeed needs, the pragmatist to buy now, and the pragmatist needs, or at least wants, to wait. Both have absolutely legitimate positions. The fact remains, however, that somewhere a clock has been started, and the question is, who is going to blink first? For everyone's sake, it had better be the pragmatist. How to make sure of this outcome is the subject of the next section. Part 2. Crossing the Chasm. 3. The D-Day Analogy. The chasm is, by any measure, a very bad place to be. It promises few, if any, new customers. Only those who have somehow got off the safe thoroughfares. But it does house all sorts of unpleasant folk, from disenchanted current customers to nasty competitors to unsavory investors. Their efforts conspire to tax the reserves of the fledgling enterprise seeking to pass through to the mainstream. We need to look briefly at these challenges so we can be alert in our defenses against them. The perils of the chasm. Let's begin with a lack of new customers. As opportunities from the early market of visionaries become increasingly saturated, with big-ticket products, this can be after as few as 5 to 10 contracts, and with a mainstream market of pragmatists nowhere near the comfort level they need in order to buy, there is simply an insufficient marketplace of available dollars to sustain the firm. Having flirted with going cash flow positive, especially during the months following one of the early market big orders, the trend is now reversed, and the enterprise is accelerating into increasingly negative cash flow. Worse still, mainstream competitors, who up to this time had paid no attention to the fledgling entry into their market, now have caught sight of a new target, experienced one or two major losses, and set their sales forces in motion to counterattack. There are few opportunities for refuge. Managers would like to retreat into their existing major account relationships, service them in an exceptional way, and leverage that investment of an additional year in fleshing out the greater part of the visionary's plan. This would not only ensure a secured reference base, but also begin to create the infrastructure of ancillary products and interfaces needed to turn a discontinuous innovation into the pragmatist's idea of a real-world solution. Unfortunately, there are no extra dollars in these accounts to pay for this year. Indeed, this year of work is far more likely to be necessary just to catch up to the promises made to secure the deal in the first place. So while there is plenty of good work to do, there is no money here. Nor can managers find safety through continuing to service just the early market. To be sure, there are still sales opportunities here, other visionaries who can be sold to. But each one is going to have a unique dream, leading to unique demands for customization, which in turn will overtax an already burdened product development group. Moreover, sooner or later in this early market, yet another entrepreneur with a yet more innovative technology and with a yet better story to tell will come along. By then, you have to be across the chasm and established in the mainstream, or you are out of luck. There is still more peril. The marketing effort